Yeah, I think we just so we're either gonna like it or not like it.
I don't have a form. Does it matter?
No, you can have informational.
Information. I'll just okay. Open up the sub.
I'd like to call the Joint Special Committee on Healthcare Transformation to order. It's Wednesday, April 13th. And colleagues, it looks like that tomorrow we are going to have a draft, maybe by the end of the day, of what the initial draft of the bill will look like. And so the plan is that as soon as we get the draft, the chairs are going to meet Friday morning to look at it to see if is this what we want to make public. And I'm hoping that it is. And as soon, and if there does need to be changes, we will get it to Lori immediately, and hopefully she'll have something out by the end of Friday then. So everyone, if you want this, a copy of this, will our administrator please explain how they can get copies?
Sure. What we'll end up doing, thank you, Chair, is when the draft is ready for public distribution, we'll post it on our committee website. I'll use our if you're signed up to get agendas already, if not, please do so. I'll send out a message on our gov delivery system telling you it's available and where it's at, so it'll save you having to call me looking for a copy.
Yes, and Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson. It's vitally important to us co-chairs that we have a document as a starting point that comes from us. And I know there's a couple other documents floating around that people have spent tons and tons of time digging through and trying to figure out what they like and what they don't like. I apologize for that. We are desperately trying to get a starting point that we all can agree to start from, and we can present to everybody so we can start moving forward. It is not our intent to continue to have you spend countless hours working on stuff that may or may not be where we're starting. So I'd like to apologize for that, and I would like to commit to you that as soon as possible that we can get a starting point, that we will have an introduction from the co-chairs for the committee for people to start working on.
And it isn't that we're disregarding what the two documents that are floating around. We're not disregarding that. We're taking things from that to be in the document, but it's so important for the co-chairs to be in agreement, and we want to start in agreement from the get-go, and so we can add and subtract and have a lot of discussion later. So that's where we are on that, and hopefully, please, once we have that out, we will be discussing how we're going to want amendments to be drafted, but as soon as you get that document, start formulating your concepts on what you like or don't like, what you want to add to it or take away from it. That is important because the timeline is going to be quick. We will be discussing Friday morning how we're going to deal with amendments, but I know what we did with the exchange, and we sent all concepts, not to individual members of the chairs, but to the committee administrator. But there will be a process on how to deal with the changes that we want to make to the bill and that you want to make to the bill.
Madam Chair, wouldn't it just be easier if everybody just said yes?
Everybody's nodding their head. I think that's got it.
It would be. And this is new. It was so nice to have just one chair, Frank, on the subcommittee for the exchange bill because he sort of was he said A or nay, and we followed his orders, and then he brought in Doc Bates and Cruz and Chip and myself. It worked well. This is going to be a little bit different, but we all three want to make it work. All right. With that, today is an informational meeting, and we want, because we don't have a document, the people that we have invited, we want them to share with us what they envision transformation to be for them and their organization. So with that, panel one is Dan Stevens, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Laura Etherton Osburn. And again, how do you interpret or define the healthcare transformation? What do you see as your role? what would be the benefits of a transformed healthcare system, what might be barriers, and are there successful models that you'd like to see that the, might be of interest to the committee?
Or just say whatever you chairs want is fine with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
It's embarrassing.
Chair Montes Anderson and co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment tonight. I'm Dan Stevens. I work for Pacific Source Health Plans, which is a local Oregon-based community not-for-profit insurance company. Our products range from commercial to Medicare to the Medicaid space. Our Medicaid products are limited to the Central Oregon and the Gorge area, with about 38,000 Medicaid members enrolled. And our CEO, Ken Preventure, participated directly with a number of you, if not all of you, on that the recent transformation team. And as one sign of consistency, the questions that I received just earlier today about what was of interest and that I wrote down and hopefully had responses to are the very ones that you mentioned. So I'll take some time and go through each of those, and I don't know if you want to have questions or hold questions until the end. But in general, as a company, we're very committed to participating in with others in healthcare transformation efforts. In fact, we really view that as a core foundational element to our strategic plan, and the initiatives that we see are the most important for our company as we move forward. So I'm excited to speak to some of those. Again, on this question of how we as an organization interpret or define transformation, this topic of definition, again, as a local not-for-profit insurance, we think this is just a foundational element to our business model. We view transformation as not something that's an end state. It's really a process and a journey. And at some level, in many, if not most, of the healthcare players' organizations today, I think there are transformative aspects to how they view their care delivery models, how we view coming together with provider partners and other partners in the community to try to enable innovative care delivery. So we view it as really a process and not an end state. That being said, I think that one of the things that we acknowledge is that true transformation isn't even beginning to be accomplished unless it's really addressing all three of those core components of the healthcare triple aim. That the customer experience has been improved, that we're actually addressing per capita cost and cost trends, and that we're actually addressing quality aspects of care. And if those three aspects aren't measurably improved, I think arguably transformation is probably not being accomplished. So that's a really important piece that we feel is vital to this. And then additionally, I think we tend to speak to kind of three essential elements of transformation. One of those is community focus. Our view is that healthcare is pretty local. Sometimes that is that calls for statewide approaches. Sometimes that calls for approaches that can be effective at truly and literally a community level. And I'll share some examples in a couple of our service areas tonight where we think there's been some pretty significant progress made around really pulling local community players together, some of the traditional stakeholders and participants and some of the non-traditional stakeholders and participants, and actually achieving a different outcome. So the local piece is important from the perspective of organizing and integrating and delivering care. Collaboration is key. And collaboration, I think, is a lot more than just pulling people together in a room and trying to talk about shared goals. It's really, I think, healthcare transformation, if we do it right in Oregon, probably calls each of the participants to really challenge their own business model. You know, if your business model as a provider is revenue maximization or fee-for-service reimbursement, I think transformation calls upon us to challenge that business model. If your business model as an insurer is to contract with providers at the lowest unit price and just pay claims and answer the phone and be nice to people, I think we need to challenge that business model too. And so together, I think transformation really, really calls on a new level of collaboration that, again, isn't just sitting around saying, what can we do that's a little bit different? And a willingness to be measured and held accountable. So how do you hold one another accountable? And I think the current framework that you're working with out of the transformation team is a good start in that regard. How do we jointly hold one another accountable for outcomes? And then delivery system reform, I think, is another core element that we see as being really important, and that isn't just the traditional providers, it's really all the participants. And I think there's a tendency sometimes to think that just reforming the financial system will enable delivery system reform. I think if you turn that on its head, that's a different and a way that we like to think about it is, let's agree on what real reform looks like and then bring financing mechanisms into place that will actually support that, as opposed to saying, you're going to be paid this way now, good luck re-engineering your business model to jump off that cliff and actually start delivering value. And just sort of requiring folks to jump off that cliff. So those are some core elements, again, just definitionally that we think are important. And in terms of I certainly can't speak for all carriers, all insurers, whether those are national, local, for-profit, or not-for-profit, but in terms of Pacific Source, what do we see as being our role in a new system? You know, the concept of a single point of accountability or managing a global budget is something that really is at the core of what we have been doing. Again, that's not feeling like you're the only ones accountable for it, but when it comes to feeling like you have the accountability to make sure people get the health care that they need in the right setting at the right time, and organizing the partnerships and the relationships that you're bringing to the table to produce that outcome, that is a role that we feel comfortable with today. I would venture to say that many carriers do, and that we ought to feel pretty comfortable with in the future, again, with a higher level of accountability to it and maybe transparency as well. So that is something that we view as a role. And then aligning partners in service to shared goals. Again, this concept of shared goals, and then supporting that with things like payment innovation, measuring outcomes, really measuring triple aim outcomes, and holding one another accountable to them. So those are roles that we view as important, not only today, but certainly going into the future. We could probably talk all night about the benefits of a transformed delivery system. I think some of the obvious ones, again, are in that we talk about triple aim outcomes a lot, obviously, in healthcare today. Predictable costs would be a benefit. Manageable cost trends. The action plan, the Oregon Action Plan for Health articulates healthier Oregonians. That certainly is an absolute benefit. We also need a higher percentage of lives covered. I attended the Healthy Kids reception just here the other night. I know some of you were there. The number that I took away was we actually in Oregon went from 12% of kids under 18 uninsured 12, 14 months ago, and we're now at 6%. That's an outcome that not a lot of states are achieving right now in the face of trying economic times and the budget environment we're in. So more of that is a good thing. And again, aligned incentives. You know, we literally have competing business models in healthcare that do not serve us well, from the purchaser to the insurer to the provider. And those competing business models have probably benefited the direct players in the healthcare system. But the losers have really been purchasers and consumers. And so when it comes to the benefits of a transformed delivery system, I think it's really that truly challenging vis-a-vis this lens of possibly a coordinated care organization or truly a single point of accountability. How do the direct participants actually share in the accountability and only win if the outcome benefits the buying customer, whether that's a public entity or a private entity, and the healthcare consumer? So those, I think, are some of the benefits that we see out of a truly transformed delivery system. I think there was a question about barriers, and barriers, again, is something we can talk about all night. Collaboration's hard work, and I know that the framework that you're working within really calls for, again, a new level of collaboration, and that's easy to say and hard to do. And we know firsthand from some work in our service areas that just how hard that is to do. Again, this notion of creating winners and losers, I think we arguably look at the healthcare players, and based on the model that's emerging, there is a tendency to say, well, whose business model really suffers in tomorrow's world? And then to sort of focus that focus on that as opposed to maybe focusing on an outcomes-based conversation. And again, I think arguably if we're doing this right, we ought to be able to look at this and say the buying customer is a winner, and the consumer of healthcare with regard to their experience and their outcome ought to be a winner, and that's just critically important. Regulatory barriers are not insignificant. I know you'll spend some time addressing those in the work of this group, and those are not insignificant. Line of business, you know, we tend to kind of think in line of business terms. There's the Medicaid population, and here's how those services get paid for. Here's the senior population, and here's how those services are paid for. Here are the dual eligibles. Here are the commercial self-funded insured. And I think that one of the barriers to transformation is again, even from the state's perspective of sort of the 850,000 lives through the OHA, starting with a portion of those total lives or a portion of the total lives in Oregon is certainly a starting point. A lot of encouragement to really work with approaches that are scalable across multiple populations, because for providers, when it comes to care delivery, those populations are really just sort of artificial mechanisms. Here's who my claim gets sent to. Here's who my payment comes from. Here's the level at which I get paid. And I get that creates conversations around access, but providers don't necessarily think in terms of Medicaid, Medicare, commercial, in terms of really taking care of that patient and putting them at the center. So I would put forth that population, the way that we think about populations can sometimes be a barrier. And then I think, you know, the final one I would just comment on is accountability. And one of the things that I think a lot of us would acknowledge in healthcare is that we've done a pretty poor job of actually asking ourselves as consumers or that patient to share in the accountability. And what this has created is sort of a hands-off approach from that consumer or that patient's perspective in terms of adherence. We know that adherence for folks that have chronic conditions is not good in American healthcare. Accessing preventive services, really doing the recommended things. And there are some emerging models that really take a serious look at that and say, if you want the best benefit plan that your employer or whomever has to offer, you actually really need to have a health profile and commit to a personal action plan around health and your own personal goals. And I think we've probably done a pretty poor job of asking that of healthcare consumers, and could probably improve on that. I think that's probably a barrier to transformation. So I can take just a couple minutes and reflect on a couple of models that we see emerging in terms of things
that we're participating in. Yes.
I'm still intrigued by the triple aim. I know everybody here knows I'm very interested in triple aim. And I'm sure your organization is really committed to health in a really essential way. Like, for example, the health of one's relationships is really dependent on health. You guys measure that and do something to improve that? Or, for example, having enough money to buy healthy food. Is that something Pacific Source helps your members on? And are you measuring the extent to which they have enough money to buy food, or
kind of the social determinants of health as opposed to...
No, I'm just talking about health. You know, the Triple Aim says health, and right. I assume by that we mean the World Health Organization definition of health, which isn't about the absence of disease. It's about things like the health of your relationship and your income security and things like that. Are you pretty much involved in that?
Right.
At Pacific Source?
Co-chairs and Representative Green, like, I think it's a great question, and it's a challenge to the insurance side of the industry and others as well. I think, it's easy to say we measure health. There are various ways we do it. One are through surveys. How are you feeling about your health this year compared to last year on a variety of fronts? How are you feeling about relationship with your provider? We don't tend to ask questions about are there barriers to you getting the right healthcare, transportation, financial security, things like that. We don't tend to do as good a job of that. We tend to measure things like rates of accessing preventive services, again, outcomes for chronic conditions over time, things like that. Probably that there is a challenge to broaden that definition of health in terms of how we measure it.
Thank you,
Senator.
That's
a fair question.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Yeah, that's Cruz. This is Bates.
Shields is the other one over there.
Yeah, okay.
Same chamber.
It's that haircut that confuses you.
Where are we going with this?
Dan, about 2 years ago, Representative Kotek and I convened a group of mental health, drug, and alcohol people in town here at the beginning of the last session and talked to them about integrating mental health, drug, and alcohol treatment and with physical health. The reaction I got after 2 or 3 weeks of emails with was apparently I'd killed my mother in broad daylight. And the outcry was horrible. But two places did step up, actually three to a certain degree, on a voluntary basis, trying to do what they knew needed to be done, which everyone knows needs to be done, and let go of their barriers. And, and Central Oregon was one of them. And you've been at it now for almost 2 years. I went to several meetings up there. I would have attended a couple more, but I got lost. They were out somewhere, and I never quite made it until it was over with. I didn't know you could have a golf course in that far away from Bend in Central Oregon.
I think I had to go to that one, too.
Yeah, it was a beautiful place when I got there, but it was over, and they were bucking hay most of the time and playing a little bit of golf, I guess. Very strange. Beautiful place. Having said all that, though, you've been at it for 2 years. You're working with three counties. So that's three county health departments and mental health groups, a multitude of county commissioners, and as well as several health plans, luckily only one hospital. And what I'd like to know is what kind of metrics are you using to find out if you're getting anywhere and how far have you actually gotten? We're looking at a program here which is going to be almost but not quite mandatory, and we want to do it in 14 months. In fact, we have to do it in 14 months to get some savings in the second half of this biennium, or we're going to be doing a reshuffle financially next February that's going to be pretty unbelievable. So just kind of give us a picture of what you got done in this length of time, what some of the barriers were, and what metrics you're using to see if you've actually made any savings, only improved outcomes, but savings in your healthcare system.
That's a great question. Co-chairs and Senator Bates, we and just to qualify, not to get me off the hook, but just to qualify, I joined the organization about 6 months ago. The integration in terms of taking on an integrated role as the fully capitated entity for physical health, medical health, mental health, and chemical dependency happened actually just in January of this year. So it probably feels like a couple of years because I know a lot of the lead-up work took some time, and that possibly as part of what's underneath your question is how much time do these things take. If I would argue that if you had a pretty significant catalyst such as some permissive legislation, you could probably shorten that time frame pretty significantly. I know there were some hoops and hurdles to jump through at a state level, a county level, and just at an organizational level. But to your question, so 1-1 of this year, that integration went live. And I know that Family Care also has that level of integration within their organization on the Medicaid side. We sort of got to January and said, okay, great, the lights are on. We've got integrated enrollment and eligibility systems. Folks know where to call when they have a question. We've communicated with patients and providers about just exactly how this will work. Now what are we going to do? We go back and revisit the vision for why we did this, because we transformed in a sense that we integrated, but we haven't transformed anything in the care delivery model. I mean, that was our acknowledgement in January. So the work is now upon us to do exactly that. And so I can speak to what we're doing really in the early going. One of the acknowledgments is that when you've got that whole picture or that single point of accountability, you can ask the question, have we really been doing whole person care coordination? And the answer is no. We've done care coordination from the mental health side, from the alcohol and drug side, and from the physical health side completely differently and probably pretty duplicatively. So we're asking that question. We've brought groups of care coordinators together that work across those entities and said, put the patient in the middle and redesign how you do this work. And if there needs to be a few less of you, let's take a look at that each organization, but put the patient in the middle and how are we going to do that? Access. We have certain areas where we have pretty good access to mental health. We have other areas where we don't have really good access at all. So we're bringing primary care providers and mental health providers together to say, how do we fix that, acknowledging that some of the systems and structures it's hard to improve access overnight. So we're looking at ways where we can embed behavioralists in places like the federally qualified health centers and some of the other primary care settings so that we can have an immediate access impact as opposed to maybe waiting for to work through the county system, which even though they're an absolutely critical and viable partner, some of those mechanisms can sometimes take a little longer. And we're honing in on that very question of what does success look like. And again, I think it looks like triple aim. It looks like triple aim measures to me. But we're working with our counties, accountable ABHA is our subcontracted partner on the mental health side. So I'd like to be able to come back to you in 6 months and say, here's what we've actually changed within the care model. One of the things that we're working hard on is as we develop initiatives that will make a difference, how do we share savings? Because Pacific Source acknowledges that if we do something that changes the dynamic of right care, right time, right setting, who reaps the benefit of that? The risk taker does, the fully capitated contractor does. So we're actually looking at and designing models that would take those savings, put them back out into the organizations that made upfront investments to enable the transformation, and hopefully collectively fund then the next round of innovation. So that's something we're actually working hard at. It's embedded in our contract with the entities that we're partnering with, and we're really committed to that. So I apologize not to have a more detailed answer just four months in or so here, but it is something we see as an enormous opportunity. And again, reflective of where can we go in the future and how can we even get there faster?
The answer being it takes time, it's early, mm-hmm. and we're hoping for the best. We sort of can't stay where we were. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you for the answer.
Do you want to sum up? On the creative models, you said you were going to mention one.
You know, the questions actually, that question allowed me to sort of reflect
answer
on one. I would just, again, I think that one of the other ones that I would just highlight briefly, and again, it's this, it's what can result from collaboration in its sort of purest form that no organization given their current business model today might have otherwise done unless they acknowledge that it would have been a detriment to their financial situation. And in Central Oregon, there's an organization called Health Matters. It's a health collaborative. There are a few of the others around the state. This is the organization that was out of the gate first with the shared care model, the multi-share model, which is a health coverage model for businesses that haven't been able to afford it. And I know there was permissive legislation that allowed that to happen. One of the underpinnings of this model is again, you have there are two levels of plan. And the richer plan is the plan where you have to step up and take personal accountability for your health and say, I commit to these things, whatever that might be given your profile. Another underpinning is a role that the hospital delivery system did not have in its discharge planning. The health insurance that the companies don't have, when we talk about nurse case management and disease management, we didn't have this role. And it's called a community health worker. And it's a paraprofessional who's community-based, not associated with any of the sort of traditional providers, and really whose sole purpose is really to attach themselves to folks who have needs. Representative Greenlee, to your point, maybe the needs are, you've had 12 ER visits in the last month and zero visits to your primary care physician. And really the nature of that is because it's a transportation issue or a can't keep an appointment issue or maybe a financial barrier. The hospital will write off my care, but my primary care provider won't, whatever the case might be. And this paraprofessional role really just gets involved with these people's lives as an advocate and an ally. And interestingly, now that this model's evolved and is emerging, the hospital is paying attention and has said, let's embed some of these in our emergency department, because if we want to address the frequent flyer issue, it's not going to be through that traditional discharge planning approach. And Pacific Source, starting with our Medicaid book of business, we've said, wow, how about we pay you on a per referral basis and actually refer some high needs patients to these community health workers? Because guess what? When the nurse calls and immediately introduces themselves as I'm so-and-so RN from Pacific Source, there's an institutional aura that goes with that these folks, again, can get past. So all of a sudden, everybody's excited about these, and the board of directors of Health Matters, which consists of hospital leaders, health insurance leaders, physician practice leaders, has said, go train 50 of these by the end of 2012 and deploy them in the community. We will figure out a way to fund it. And that is now becoming sort of a foundational underpinning of a higher level of care coordination that's playing out in Central Oregon than we've had before. So that's another just example that I wanted to highlight. And again, coming together in a spirit of collaboration, I think, creates that. That one doesn't challenge anybody to rethink their business model. It's sort of a feel good. Let's help fund this. But again, it is transformation. I think at a very core level. So,
Representative Kotex.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dan, thanks for being here, and thanks for all the work. I want to hone in a little bit more on the community health workers. Who are they? What's their training? How do we ramp it up? Because I think it's a lot of us see this as a critical part of the CCO model,
right.
And it's not. They are paraprofessionals.
Right.
We also want individuals who are culturally. They can, you know, reduce those cultural barriers, reaching certain populations. What are you doing, and where are your folks coming from?
Right. That is a great question, co-chairs and Representative Kotek. The training is something that I can't speak to at a detailed level. The college, interestingly, has stepped up, the Central Oregon Community College, and there's a partnership with the college to actually have a 10-week course. There's not a formal licensure or certification. Again, it's a paraprofessional. But there really are those aspects of cultural competency, and these are people from multitude of backgrounds, and in some cases, folks who this is really the first job they've had, and one of the goals is obviously to relate to folks who really are struggling with some of the very same issues, whether those be abuse or whatever the case might be. So, but the training really is. There is a counseling aspect to it. We can certainly get and share more information if anybody's interested. There's a counseling aspect to it, an advocacy aspect of it, training about the healthcare system and how to navigate and advocate for people, communication methods, behavioral interviewing, and absolutely cultural competency. So that's at a high level, but we can certainly get more detail and share that if the committee's interested. But the Central Oregon Community College has stepped up and now has a program to help us reach this goal in the community of getting to 50.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to see more info. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
For
Thank
coming.
You for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Laura.
Co-chair. Senator Monis Anderson and Representative Friedman. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the healthcare advocate with Osperg. Osperg's a consumer organization in the state. We've been around for about 40 years. I know that because, unfortunately, I know that because the organization was founded in the year of my birth, and it will be turning 40 just next month.
Happy birthday!
Oh, thank you. I wanted to also just say that Osperg has come to the issue of working on healthcare really through our consumer protection work, through our work on looking at what are the issues that face families and face individuals financially and in the quality of their lives. When you compare the quality of healthcare with the quality or safety of toys, I think the quality of healthcare is significantly more profound, though we'll keep working on making sure that toys are safe for children. Healthcare is also in a tremendous part of what any family faces in terms of their family budget, and so it's a significant issue, and it's been a pleasure to take that on. Osperg also works together with a range of other organizations across the state from a variety of different perspectives, whether that be organizations that focus more on low-income issues and more access issues on healthcare, some that work more on quality or some more on cost issues. And I am honored to work with a broad coalition of folks, and I hope that you will not take any of my comments tonight as speaking for the whole community, but rather just from one perspective, and urge you to hear from a variety of consumer perspectives over the course of this very important task that you have in front of you. I think overall, the main message that I would want to convey tonight is that consumers have a vital role to play in as partners, together with all of the different partners in making sure we can transform our health system and continue to transform it as we move forward in the future. That consumers have a right to be involved in what their healthcare system will look like, and we have a responsibility to be involved in what that system looks like and to make sure that we're getting healthier along the way. Consumers are very clear on one of the problems in healthcare. I think consumers have a absolutely crystal clear idea that it costs more than it should. I have yet to talk to any consumers who feel that healthcare might be a little underpriced, that they might not be paying quite as much in those out-of-pocket costs or in terms of their premiums as maybe they ought to. Most people are feeling pretty darn squeezed, whether they have employer-based coverage or they're paying for it with themselves. Folks are getting really clobbered on healthcare and honestly don't know how they're going to keep up with the rising costs. They have good reason to feel like that. The Kaiser Family Foundation did a study, and according to them, just right here in Oregon, premiums for a family, an average premium for employer-based coverage for a family will reach about $27,000 by 2016. And that's a chunk of change that I think takes everyone a step back and thinks, okay, we can't afford that. What are we going to do? That's not too far away. We're on track to get there, and we know we have to transform the system. We know we have to have a different system. We know we want it to cost less, and that the increases can't keep going up like they're going up. So that's one part. I think the whether or not we're getting the quality we want is something that consumers experience when they have an experience in the healthcare system, when they have a loved one who has an experience in the healthcare system. Sometimes the experiences are very good. I know that both Dan and I have sprained ankles right now, for example, and I'm sure both of us got pretty good care. We're on the mend. It's a strange thing to have two panel members with sprained ankles. Is it your left foot?
That's why we were together. It's my left foot.
Yeah, it's my left foot, too. It's really weird. Consumers largely get good care. We get good quality, but all of us know someone who has had a bad experience or has had an experience where something wasn't caught when it should have been, or when, frankly, someone should have gotten the preventative care and they didn't, whether that's getting the screening when they should have, or any other, getting an immunization for their child when they should have. So I think there's growing awareness that the quality, we're paying a lot, and the quality isn't where it should be. The other piece of this struggle is that we're just not as healthy here in Oregon or here in America as we ought to be and as healthy as we would like to be. I also haven't talked to any consumers yet who feel really happy that they haven't lost those 20 pounds yet, but they've been really meaning to lose. I know that all of us are trying to eat salad and go jogging a whole lot more, except when we have sprained ankles and then we want to hold off on the jogging for a few more weeks. But I think all of us are struggling on how do we get to all of these places. So I think from the consumer perspective, the trip lane is pretty intuitive. We need to reduce the cost of health care. We need to improve the quality of care. And we need to get healthier. In terms of strategies moving forward into transformation, to actually implement those three pieces, we're excited about the conversations about actually getting healthcare costs to increase maybe at a fixed rate of growth. That is good. I think a low fixed rate of growth would be definitely preferable, so that we can actually plan accordingly and have the system be sustainable. To get there, consumers are worried about whether that means cutting needed care. And I think it's important for us to, at every turn, convey that we are not talking about cutting costs by cutting needed care. We're actually talking about cutting costs by improving care, doing it better, getting better results, and keeping people healthier in the first place so that we don't have to incur huge costs on the back end when people are sicker than they should have been. In terms of improving the quality of care, the increasing focus on patients being at the center of their care, being part of a decision-making team together with their healthcare provider or their team of providers, is something that consumers respond to, I think, very well and are excited about. Similarly, I think that consumers want to be not only at the center of their care when they are on that table in the clinical examining room, and they've got the stupid dress on with the ties in the back, but they want to be at the center of their care as the healthcare system is getting designed and as it gets continually improved. And we'd like to be partners both in designing how it should be and taking responsibility for how it really gets implemented all along the way. In terms of measuring, as we go forward, I think this is an incredibly key aspect for us to both make sure that we have good accountability to ourselves about how we're doing as we're moving forward on everything from safety to the effectiveness of care to how well we're integrating to are we moving, getting the care to folks at the right time, focusing on prevention as opposed to getting care later, is the evidence for the care there, all of those pieces as we're measuring both the not only the outcomes that we're getting, but we need to measure what we're doing to get there. So having both measurements on the processes that the healthcare system across the system is taking, and also measurements on the outcomes. How are the processes that we're undertaking actually working? Are we getting healthier? Are we delivering the right care? And to wrap up, I think the increasing the conversations that have gone on about really making this a more local system, a system of real local accountability, is an exciting one. And I would encourage that process to include payers, providers, and people. So people in the community at every step of the way. And for this change, not just to stop, of course, with the Medicaid program, but for this to extend into the full health care system for all Oregonians. While it's the budget crisis and a huge opportunity to fix how we handle Medicaid in this state, people who have insurance in other ways and people who are uninsured are desperately wanting transformation across the board. So we need to extend this beyond so that everyone can gain the benefits. I think that's the extent of sort of the 80,000 foot. We're excited about healthcare transformation. We want to be partners in the process. And but when I say we, I mean ordinary consumers, people who are in consumer organizations or health organizations, broad consumers across the way. We want to be part of the. We know we're part of the problem, and we definitely want to be part of the solution. Thank you.
Thanks for our questions. All right. Thank you very much, panel. The last panel we have is Kathleen O'Leary, Tina Nickel, and Commissioner Tammy Bainey from Deschutes County.
Hello, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties, as well as in my official capacity as chair of the Board of County Commissioners for Deschutes County. And I want to start off by thanking all of you for your time and effort and energy in this transformation. It matters a great deal. And I just had heard that we were flying at about 80,000 feet. I like to fly more VFR, a little closer. Oh, Tammy Bainey. Sorry. Yes, and I would know that to know to do that. But I like to fly a little closer to the ground, a little more VFR. So I'm going to give a little bit more of a perspective of on the ground. So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much for this opportunity. And we do support the work in the vision of the Triple Aim. And we also care about the reform that Governor Kitzhaber has called for, and we appreciate that effort. As partners in governance, we at the county believe that healthcare transformation provides both opportunities and challenges, and I think that's why we're here today. I'd like to highlight some of those challenges and offer what we believe to be opportunities to improve the system as it exists. And, of course, we were working on this since the dawn of time, so it's important that we get it right this time. As many of you are aware, counties serve as the local public health and mental health authority, and as commissioners, we're responsible for the health and well-being of our constituents, and our constituents are your constituents as well, so we have a locked partnership there. Most of the we are the providers of last support. we see every day, whether it's at Safeway or at the local library, exactly what the needs are in our communities, and I know that you do as well. We provide the safety net that makes sure that everyone gets the treatment that they need and deserve. One of the pressing challenges of the transformation is that the funding of the health safety net is braided together with the Medicaid funds. With those dollars, the Medicaid funds come to the counties to help provide the infrastructure that allows the counties to provide the care for those who do not qualify for Medicaid. AOC, the Association of Oregon Counties, concern stems from unbraiding the Medicaid and other funding streams, such as the state and county general funds, and creating a bifurcated system. And it's the economies of scale. It's a reality. Bifurcating Medicaid and the safety net will leave the counties with a high-risk, high-need population. Bifurcating Medicaid and the safety net will leave the counties with dramatically less resources to serve the indigent population. And bifurcating the system will merely shift costs to the public safety, education, and child welfare systems, which I know are all braided into this as well. One of my colleagues in Josephine County had offered when we were back in Washington, D.C., they had a constituent who needed a triple bypass, and so he committed a crime to be incarcerated to receive care. Those are the realities that we all face. Operating with the local public health authority, counties provide preventative services such as targeted case management for nurse home visiting, HIV and AIDS, and maternal case management. Medicaid remains an important funding stream for those local services. In Central Oregon, and I want to thank my colleague Dan Stevens for giving such a wonderful and articulate overview of what we've been up to in the Central Oregon area. We did start over 18 months ago, but it was actually February of 2010 that we as three counties came together and determined that we could play well in the sandbox and wanted to be able to look at our health care in a different way in our communities. We share a lot of the same residents because they may work in one community and live in another community, and quite frankly, none of those folks care exactly where the county lines are. They just want to have their needs met. So I have come to appreciate, and we all have, that we have a critical role as a county in helping create change and focus on the health of over 225,000 people who call Central Oregon home. A brief history, of course, as I mentioned, in 2010, we came together with the Oregon Health Authority. Senator Gates is one of our esteemed members as well. St. Charles Health System, one of the benefits for us is we share the same hospital system in the three-county area, and I would underscore that. Our fully capitated health plan, which is Pacific Source, you heard from them earlier, and our safety net, which is the federally qualified health care center, and ABHA, which is our mental health organization. We all came together to focus on the health of our region. Last July, we decided that as the three counties, we wanted to formalize our regional effort, and the things that we're working on is a comprehensive look at our public funds in our health services, which in our area is about $100 million, which includes federal, state, and county resources. And we want to move to a single Medicaid contract, which is not easy, as well as better align our planning policies, priorities, and resources. And we do a lot of planning on the county level, which is costly. What have we learned so far? Well, we're like a herd of turtles. It's slow. Far too many people in our area are uninsured, over 40,000 in our region. 19% in Deschutes County are uninsured. It's completely unacceptable. Our system has been fragmented far too long. Integration is necessary, but is not easy, and it is not free. We all have to have skin in this game. Local public and private groups can work together effectively to improve health and to improve care and to reduce costs. And in our area, it's not just a suggestion, it's a requirement. Counties play a vital role with transparency, with the public health and mental health, and with our connection to the safety net efforts and our community involvement and the support of the local nonprofits, which I would underscore that as well, because again, it is a community effort and it's not just government. Our own county can make all the difference by calling for change, and with this we offer resources. Just recently we offered land for telecare to come in and do a 16-bed mental health facility, and we also invest a little over $3.6 million from general fund on an annual basis into public health and mental health in the Deschutes County area alone. So we are committed and invested in making this better for all of our residents in partnership with the state. Lastly, the health and healthcare costs left unattended damage our economic vitality and our future. Finally, we have a meeting tomorrow right here in room 167. It's the Central Oregon Health Council meeting from 1 to 3 o'clock, and I encourage each of you to come and see what we've been up to, ask any questions you might have. And as you consider the benefits of collaboration and community action, including the help of the counties, I leave you with a couple of items and topics that we'll be discussing tomorrow, because this is a work in progress. The first is that in 2011, our region's new emergency room diversion project has reduced ER visits by our frequent flyers by more than 50%. And of those, 271 had less visits than those with the Medicaid patients. One individual in a 12-month period had accessed the ER in 12 months 62 times, which when you look at quality of care, quality of life, it's dismal. To reach the goal of all the partners, we needed to be able to invest our resources together, and we are now seeing the savings from those expenditures. And I will tell you that it has been lengthy, and it has been difficult, but I think that some of the lessons that we've learned on a local level we could share with other communities, and it may not have to take quite as long. The role of the counties in the governance of a coordinated care organization is important and critical. There needs to be a formal relationship between the counties and the CCOs. This relationship not only needs to spell out the governance structure, but the service delivery and financial agreements between the two parties. We also have been attempting to make these relationships formal with the Central Oregon Health Council, but our lawyers have found that it is difficult. We've been trying to use the statute of 190, but then 190 statute is used for many nonprofits or partnerships. You may not want to have 190 opened up to allow more public-private. So we were trying to come up with our own, and it's been quite a task.
Can we stand on that? Can you tell us what...
Statute 190 allows for local governments to come together collectively to form, in essence, a government entity, and so you are allowed to do that, but in the statute it does not allow you to also enter into a contractual agreement as an entity with a private party, so it doesn't allow that piece. So we've been trying to figure out a way that allows for that, and we're working off a memorandum of understanding.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty important, though. Thank you. I mean, that could be something that's really critical to the stuff we're talking about, because we are talking about the kind of organizations that you're playing with there, and if there are statutory barriers to the contracting arrangements, that may be one of the things we have to have on the agenda.
You need to be very careful.
Yeah.
Unintended consequences of opening not too wide, but...
And Madam Chair, Senator, I would say exactly the same. That's why we have not tried to go any further on a 190. I believe that would the unintended consequences of opening that may benefit one, but hinder in the long run. So I think there are other ways that we can get there, and we'll be discussing that a bit more tomorrow between 1 and 3 in room 167. It's crucial that legislation establishes a statutory relationship between the counties and the CCOs to avoid any potential conflicts in the future. So again, I would underscore, and the main reason there is we're working off a memorandum of understanding, and that's working quite well because, again, as I said, we require in our area that it work. We don't have time to have turf wars or any of that, or to just look at county boundaries and et cetera. It's important that we make sure that we have, if all the players were to change, we still had something in place that would hold us together. There's a saying with the Association of Oregon Counties that if you've seen one county, you have seen one county. We all know that as you travel across the state, each community is unique. And with this, the different communities have different needs and expectations, which all demand a unique solution. This will require statutory flexibility to allow communities to have input in the design, governance, and outcomes of the CCOs. As elected officials and the Mental Health and Public Health Authority, much of this responsibility will be with the commissioners. And underscore again that we're partners. This reinforces the need for strong statutory language that creates a formal relationship between the counties and the CCOs. There's no sense in tearing down what works and building something new. Counties have established relationships with the mental health organizations and local service providers. These relationships should not be destroyed, but rather be built upon. Mental health and addictions operational and financing expertise can bring unique assets to the table for ACCO design planning, the request for proposal process, and implementation. These experts can help us understand our options for transitioning from our current MHO-based model to the future CCO-based model. And also, there should be ongoing formal involvement by both mental health and addictions experts in the work of the Oregon Health Policy Board. And often when we were seeing people in our ER, it was dual diagnosis. It was, it's just a hodgepodge, and I'll get to that. Let's continue to invest in the programs that are working to reduce long care costs, preventative programs like early psychosis intervention, children's system change initiative, adult mental health initiative, the Aim High, have proven to reduce hospitalizations and decrease costs. Immunizations, teen pregnancy prevention, and tobacco prevention and education are public health interventions that reduce costs to the healthcare system. By investing in early intervention and prevention programs, we can continue to bend, with investing in those, we can continue to bend the cost curve. So I wanted to close by saying that we believe in the shared accountability, but also shared risk. And we're doing that by partnering with the private sector in our community. We believe in prioritizing whole patient care coordination because we know that we can't just look at one part of a patient. It has to be comprehensive. And we look forward to working with you to tackle these challenges and overcoming obstacles. And by working together, we can achieve the triple aim and help create a healthier Oregon. Thank you. Any questions?
Further questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you.
Yes.
For your testimony and for your work. I'm curious, of the $100 million that you referenced, what percentage comes from local resources?
I can tell you, Madam Chair, Senator, from the Deschutes County perspective, we do $3.6 million, and that would be a local investment. And so outside of that, a lot of what you're going to find are your state and federal dollars.
Okay, thank you.
It is a small amount, but I do know that those help to bridge the gaps and needs within a community that are not being covered in other areas. And it also helps if it's something such as if we have a high onset of childhood obesity, but that's where CCO can come together and talk about what those issues might be, and then the local general fund dollars can invest in those issues that are coming up in emerging trends in a community. So they may be small in the big picture, but they're really vital on the ground.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Well, I echo first thanks for your job. I know it hasn't been easy, and I apologize for not being there more often. It's a long drive to get into your area, but I'm supposed to be on your organization. I just follow everything you send me. One of the areas I'm concerned about, and for CCOs that are Medicaid-based, and that's what these are going to be to start with, the gap that I see they're going to be dealing with is the uninsured individuals who come into the county for mental health and drug and alcohol treatment. Asking them to take that burden on and not bifurcating that is a real concern here because the counties accept that. You use some of the Medicaid money you get to kind of, I hate to use the word cost share, but you build your infrastructure primarily on Medicaid and then try to get everybody in under the tent there. What do you have any idea what percentage in those three counties are uninsured people who don't qualify for Medicaid at this time, but you're still serving with mental health and drug and alcohol treatment?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I do not know exactly. I do know in our area there are 19% of the population, and we have a population of 160,000 that do not meet the Medicaid requirements, but I don't know how many of those would actually be eligible or need the mental health. Possibly Ms. Nickel might. Do you have any idea?
I just want to make sure that we're going to discuss that issue in this
right.
panel before we get through this issue, because if we don't know what those CCOs' risks are and what they're really taking on. If they're being asked to take that on, that's a significant issue. If they're not asked to take that on, then you've got a system where the counties are picking up that little small chunk and they've lost the rest of it, so that we have to work that out.
And, Madam Chair, Senator, possibly that's where the general fund comes in to help offset some of those costs. Again, I think
there
it gets...
There isn't any general fund.
Well, county general fund.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Let me be clear. Thank you. Yes, county general fund.
And that could be
because it can
it
for var- some counties.
It varies from county to county.
It does. It does.
Dramatically.
As will all the CCOs. It will vary, and they won't look the same. but it's I think it's important that counties do invest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Senator Monis Anderson, Representative Freeman, committee members, my name is Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And every once in a while, I teach a class on healthcare financing at OHSU. So this has been a really interesting journey. I have a lot of paper in front of you, and I just want to have a conversation tonight about the global aspects from a mental health and addictions point of view. We have a national council that we work with, the association works with, and we have been taking a look at healthcare transformation for a long time. So I just provided you with a little light reading material for it at night. You'll go through this and you'll see that it's exactly what we've been talking about. How do we turn a sick care system into a health care system? And I appreciate all the conversation that has come before us, because we really do need to turn the paradigm on its head. We've been spending a lot of money on the most costly parts of the system in mental health and addictions. We need to turn that around and spend the money in prevention. In the 1980s, we as a state spent a lot more money in prevention. We got a lot more money from the federal government for prevention. We were actually able to see some of the numbers turn around. And then that money went away. And now we're starting to see a lot more problems with mental health and addictions because the money has slowly eroded away. In the hospital master plan, one of the things that we did was a financial study as a group. We got 150 people in the state to take a look at what is missing. And it said that about $500 million was missing out of the community, out of the community system. Well, there's no way we have that money. So I just wanted to point that out as we take a look for your purposes. I just wrote a model of what this system could look like and where we need to move to. This is not the end all, but it is something that we are moving towards and have to figure out all the pieces. So mental health and addictions is an area that has a lot of expertise in it, but as we move towards what coordinated care really looks like, we need to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, meaning that MHOs, dental care organizations, and fully capitated health plans have certain area of expertise that we need to learn from. And as we come together, we need to make sure that those lessons learned are not thrown out as we hurry towards this process. We're looking forward to working with you on this. We think that one of the things, the most crucial thing that you could do is really form a group that measures outcomes and assigns outcomes. We have been asking for that for a long time, and we don't have an agreed upon set of outcomes, so the target is always moving. Again, we spend a lot of money, time, and energy measuring widgets. So we give encounter data. We measure all these things that we don't use particularly. They're important and they're interesting, but they don't get to an outcome. So we're asking in the legislative concept that you have those measurements, or at least design a work group that can have those targeted measurements. One of the things that I also provided for you is AOCMHP, the association, looked at this for mental health and addictions, and we started this work, and we outlined what we thought our metrics should be in mental health and addictions. Now, it doesn't matter whether you use those or not. But again, that's a basis that it would really be helpful. I think you could have the flexibility with the money if you did what the targeted metrics were and underscored that. I don't have to tell you, I provided some articles for you. I think a key thing that you're going to see is the spillover effect from untreated mental health and addictions. Those really are part of the cost drivers, at least in that part of the system, and we need to address that. Bending the health cost curve by expanding alcohol and drug treatment is going to be crucial, and we need to take a look at that. Again, one of the things that Dr. Goldberg has asked us over the years is how do we become a world-class organization? And there are pieces that mental health and addictions need to do better, absolutely. But there are also pieces that we have done very, very well and need to be considered in the CCOs as we blend all this together. We have over 150, I'm going to call them mini integration projects. Now, some of them are true integration projects where physical health care, mental health and addictions, and dental care have come together and had a one-stop shopping center. I remember when I was a county commissioner and not reelected for my third term over that very issue is trying to blend and integrate service care. And so I'm grateful that we're to this point in blending things together.
Gina, before you move on, I'm looking at the core outcome recommendations on page 4 of one of the documents that's labeled AOCMHP Outcomes Work Group.
Yes.
And do you think that this should be a part of the transformation document listing core outcome recommendations, or do you look at maybe the RFPs that would be coming into the health authority to design their own core outcome recommendations?
Madam Chair, I believe that the legislature should convene a group to guide it. I don't think that it should be left up to whoever responds to the RFP. I think there should at least be some guidance.
Thank you. Continue.
And so what I want to leave you with is as we redesign this system, there's a lot of expertise out there. I think the CCOs will morph and look different even a year or 2 years from now as the expertise melds together. I think that there's a lot of people that have expertise now, but I really think we're moving, and it's going to be not an end point. I think, as Dan said earlier, we are moving in that direction together. I do want to point out that there are some things that the legislature could do right now, and they may be a little bit painful because I know that you don't have money, but these... One of the considerations is where do you make sure that there's no cost shifting? Where do you spend money on now that can save later? And one of those that I know you've heard about, but I have to underscore it, is the early psychosis programs. The early assessment, screenings, and treatments and supports. You, in your wisdom, funded that up to 60% and in past legislative sessions, and we are really finding some good outcomes. That program is going to do a presentation on May 6th, and you'll have an opportunity to hear more about that, and we'll get invites out to you. But we're only in 60% of the state. It would cost $2.7 million to put that in 100% of the state, and you'll be saving money on the other end, and we'll get you that data. Again, the MHOs are involved in the Aim High project. I'm not going to tell you a lot about that because I know you've heard that from AMH. We're starting to see some cost shifts to the good of money that we're saving as we transfer people out of the state hospital and into community settings. There's also little-known programs such as DDA, Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, that are in 34 of the 36 counties. We're seeing people with dual diagnosis, and we're seeing people in the prison wraparounding support that keep them from being hospitalized. I also wanted to mention the peer mentors support group program. Many counties have peer supports. They are more cost effective. A lot of people that have issues or challenges want to have the expertise of somebody that has been there. These people are paraprofessionals. AMH has designed a program. We're going to look at certifying people. I've got a telephone call today from some community colleges that are taking a look at providing curriculum certification. I think those are very, very necessary in building a great healthcare system. You don't have an easy job. And we want you to know that mental health and addictions, your community mental health and addictions, both public and private, look forward to helping you to figure out how to make this work. And we don't have many suggestions for saving $850 million in the next year, but we do have some that we think can go a long ways. And we look forward to helping you with the triple aim, or at least the double and a half aim. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Just one comment. I feel that you listed some core outcome recommendations. Mm-hmm. That's what I would hope would come out of, I haven't conferred with my co-chairs, but there really needs to be quality outcomes as a part of a CCO. And I'm hoping that recommendations in amendment form or concepts would come to us, because we sort of need to get a handle on what people feel is doable. I mean, yes, we can have all of the core outcomes, but what's reasonable on implementing them also. So would appreciate that once you get the original, finally, a document to work from. Look at that piece in particular. Thank you.
All right. Kathleen.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monis Anderson, Co-Chair Freeman, Co-Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen O'Leary, and I chair the Coalition of Local Health Officials, which represents the collective interests of the 34 local health departments. And thank you for inviting me here this evening to talk about health care transformation and local public health. Four areas of interest that I'd like to chat with you about this evening. Local public health in Oregon, the benefits of health care transformation, some concerns or possible unintended consequences that we would like to point out, and the role of local public health in health reform. Health care is delivered in clinics and in offices, but health actually starts in our families, our schools, our parks, our workplaces, literally the air we breathe and the food and water that we consume. Public health focuses on prevention, how to keep health, not just how to get it back. And to do this, we focus on the whole community. Our public health system provides a structure of opportunity that's available to all of us. And when that's strong and secure, we all stay healthy and avoid disease. I start right my remarks here because there's a lot of talk about health, and there's a lot of talk about health care, and they are overlapped. And I think it really is important for us to be intentional about how we use health and health care. So tonight I'm going to talk about health care reform, really with a health lens, and I'm hoping that that will illuminate some of the strengths and challenges of this transformation. We believe that healthcare transformation is crucial to improve the quality of primary care that's delivered and to reduce costs. This is simply work that must be done. And while there's a lot of conversation regarding prevention, healthcare reform alone will not get us to improve population health. Public health fully supports a patient-centered primary care home model that focuses on integration of services including physical, mental, and oral health, quality measures based on benchmarks, sensitivity to culture, language, and health literacy, and containment of health care costs through accountability. Local public health is very engaged with and is bringing assets to the health reform planning. We have experience and expertise using a continuum of health team members that reduce costs and matches patients to the level of care that they need and they want. And we do this by using nurses and nurse practitioners at the top of their licensure in our clinics, by using public health nurses working as case managers with families in their homes, and coordinating that care with the client. Primary medical home, extending that primary care home, if you will. And we employ paraprofessionals and culturally and linguistically appropriate community health workers. We really do know how to do this work. We do have some concerns and some possible unintended consequences that we would like to point out. First, including specific language connecting the new health entities to the local mental health and public health authorities, both for governance and contracting, is pivotal. Boards of County Commissioners, as you so eloquently heard from Commissioner Bainey, are the statutory boards of health and are accountable to the public. Public health and mental health systems are both state and local, and the public accountability needs to be both state and local. So we do recommend that there continues to be a statutory role for local government with these new entities. Counties, we will continue to be responsible for the health of all of the residents within our jurisdictions, and potentially without some infrastructure services that we have right now. So we need to make sure that that's not an unintended consequence as we look at the new coordinated care organization work. We also have experience with and would like to participate in the development of the metrics that lead to identifying good health outcomes. In addition to our regulatory work and our systems and policy initiatives, local public health provides high-quality preventive clinical and home-based services. For most counties, these services are related to larger public health strategies like teen pregnancy prevention, healthy mothers and healthy babies, preventing vaccine-preventable diseases, reducing the spread of sexually transmitted infections, and addressing latent tuberculosis infections. We do have a few counties that are FQHCs and therefore provide primary care as well. Health departments weave together a variety of funding to be able to provide these services, and that includes billing Medicaid. So coordinating and contracting with CCOs or another funding mechanism will be needed to maintain these vital services. Our public health focus on the entire population and our focus on primary prevention are central to health reform efforts. The policy and systems level work that we do creates conditions for people to stay healthy, which reduces the work and the cost to the health care sector. Fewer healthy people use fewer expensive health care services. And here I'm talking really about that population work that we do, tobacco reduction, obesity prevention, communicable disease control, preventing foodborne illnesses, injury prevention. It's that work that we do with city and county planners, with active transportation advocates, the active work around access to healthy food initiatives, the work with schools and parks and recreation. Remember that the members of CCOs will leave their appointments or their health class or the counseling session and go to their communities. And we all know how hard behavior change around good, healthy behaviors is. So we really do need to provide environments that support everyone in terms of good health behaviors, tobacco-free environments, access to healthy food, sidewalks, bicycle paths, safe routes to schools. Health reform has been really a very good catalyst for public health. We are engaging with new and existing partners to pull together. That includes mental health, FQHCs, health systems,
health plans, a variety of providers, dentists, really coming together to plan, to think, to test the waters a bit, to figure out together what the changing environment is, and quite frankly, to evolve together. This has been quite a catalyst, and we've learned quite a bit from Central Oregon. Thank you very much. Some additional issues for your consideration. We believe that the new healthcare entities need to be locally or regionally defined. Communities are more successful when they can build on existing strengths with known partners who are committed to addressing the inevitable challenges. Our state is varied, and our solutions also need to be diverse. For example, in rural counties, where there are fewer healthcare providers and more miles between the clinics, they will have very different challenges and assets than more urban areas where we may be coordinating with a variety or multiple CCOs. And so we need good solutions in all parts of our state. The current healthcare transformation work is really important, and the work for the members that are covered by CCOs is crucial, but it really isn't work at this point around increasing access to care. And while that's entirely understandable, again, public health addresses health for all of the residents within our jurisdictions. So some of our concerns revolve around who's going to care for people not covered by a CCO, what services will be available for those individuals, and what resources will help fund the services for those folks. Those are very real concerns for us.
Can you have just a moment?
Yes.
If you consider yourself at the county level, and I've asked this question,
yes,
many counties, responsible for the health of your population, do you also consider yourself the payer of last resort for any health care services that population needs?
That has been a traditional public health role, and we certainly do that in our clinical and home visiting services where individuals are not turned away for inability to pay.
So the CCU can take you as a person at risk for the final dollar when it when the money runs out?
Well, that's part of why I'm pointing pointing this out, Representative Greenlick, because I think that as we look at what the system will look like, we not only have to look at who's covered and what will that those benefits look like, but who is not covered, who's not under the tent, and what will that look like, and how do we collectively come together to address those folks as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And finally, we applaud and support healthcare reform efforts and transitions. They're absolutely critical. But I think it's also critical that we get to initiatives that truly improve health. One of the diagrams that you have in the materials that I gave to you is Frieden's health impact pyramid. And if we look at healthcare reform, that's all work at the top of the pyramid, which requires much more intensive work with fewer population advantages overall. So I think that part of our work, part of the public health focus, is to drive those conversations to the bottom of that pyramid, where we do look at the social determinants of health, good education, employment, housing, and we look at the systems level and policy work that we do to engineer healthy communities. Thank you for this opportunity this evening, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Quiet committee tonight. Yes, Senator, or Representative Tuckett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here tonight, especially Tammy. I know you had to come a long way. Thank you. So throughout all of your testimonies, you talk about a formal contractual relationship. What exactly do you want to see in statute around this?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, thank you. Good to see you as well. I don't have the exact language, but we have it. Can I bring it to you, because we have some ideas of what that would look like.
Please.
We want to make
and share it with
the whole committee.
The administrator.
Okay, because I think that would be, to go off the top of my head, I'm going to miss some things, but if I could get that document to you, I think that would be beneficial. We've been working on that we've been working on it for months now, and it's whittled down. So if we could, it talks about that accountability and the shared risk piece. And I think the one piece that we haven't been able to really identify is what we would do with shared savings. I think that's going to be something that'll be, but of course that could happen outside of that.
Hello? Shared savings from?
Well, when you have a CCO, mm-hmm, and everyone is in the has skin in the game, and you're looking at ways that you're going to benefit the population that you're there to serve, mm-hmm. there should be cost savings. And then how will that be reinvested back into the communities, and what would that be reinvested as? And I don't think that that is the nut that we've cracked quite yet. So it's kind of a two-pronged as I look at what language is necessary for us to have a good, strong statutory piece. I think also you have to have that piece of what is it going to look like when, not only how are you going to work well together, but how are you going to share in those cost savings as well?
Hello? So, I have to admit, I'm still wrestling with this because I think, you know, I respect the work the counties are doing. I know you're the mental health authority and the public health authority. I also worry sometimes. I get that we don't want to undermine the safety net services that are non-Medicaid related. So just hypothetically, if we could guarantee that you wouldn't see a net loss in those dollars to serve the non-Medicaid population, and kind of having county kind of step aside for innovation in the CCO, is that a possibility? Or, I mean, I don't want to undermine the safety net services that are non-Medicaid related, but if we're just focusing on the Medicaid population, mm-hmm. and if we have a successful CCO, theoretically, the county benefits, and if we can maintain the level of resources you need to do all the other things that somehow wouldn't be involved, and you're collaborating, I'm not, maybe not formally, but as one big community partner, I'm just trying to get at trying to allay your concerns, but also allow for flexibility.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think, though, it doesn't just come down to dollars. It comes down to the whole patient coordination. And I think it comes down to the planning around what that looks like and making sure that you have a good whole patient coordination around in your community. So I think you could take, and in some areas, I know that that there are some counties that say, you know, I want to contract this all out. I really, there are going to be three CCOs in my area, and it just doesn't fit exactly what we have. And so I think that's why you're hearing a theme here, flexibility of being able to allow communities to determine what's going to work best. Some communities, it may not work best to have a county as part of a CCO. I can't tell you that isn't out of the realm of reality. But I can tell you in some communities, because of the way that things are blended together and the relationships that are already there, and relationships in a lot of the smaller communities mean dollars and time and investment in ways in achieving a goal together that just funding it will not achieve. So I caution in taking all of that away. I think some communities, sure, I think you would have counties saying, yeah, I could take it or leave it. I think you're going to have other counties saying, well, not just counties, but I think you're going to have the private sector saying, we need the county in to help us with that planning and to help us with that whole patient care coordination piece that can't just be done by one fragment of the puzzle. And I would follow up, if I may. You know, as an elected official, too, you get hung up on these, oh, we're the Public Health and Mental Health Authority. I really could care less. At the end of the day, it's about serving the people that we all have been elected to serve. And so if it's a change in that structure, I think that counties would be willing to have a conversation around that as well. I think what we want to just have is that transparency and a way that we can achieve the same common goals collectively at the most cost-efficient manner.
Thank you.
Well, the question line you open up, and the question line you're trying to answer is one of the keys to this. And we've already seen some unintended consequences in other areas in relation with counties and partnerships. We have counties, as an example, in foster care have stepped up and have reduced their foster care roles and have paid the price for that. They're looking at reduced budgets because their foster care roles have gone down. We have the counties who have chosen not to step up, have increased their foster care roles, gone in the completely wrong direction, and are rewarded for that by having more money coming in. It's happening right now. So I'm going to be cautious about what I say here to a certain degree. Those counties that don't step up and want to work with CCOs should not be rewarded for that kind of behavior. And those that do should. If you have a global budget with shared savings in it, you should be able to keep those savings and reinvest in your program so you can maintain them, improve them, and enlarge them. That has not been the way government normally works. If we don't break that with the CCOs, then we will fail. And that's a warning to other counties out there. I'll give you a tale of two counties some other time that sit next to each other in Southern Oregon
and one is being rewarded for bad behavior, and one's being punished for good behavior. So I think that's what you're really talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we want people like you to have your shared savings kept in your county.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, yes, amen.
Thank you.
Well said.
I love this talk about shared savings, because our basic premise is it's going to be the losses that are going to be shared, since we're starting with roughly 20% less money than we need to do what do it. So I think how to divide shared savings would be wonderful. The real question is, who takes the responsibility for the shared losses when the CCO runs out of money, as it's likely to do after 8 months, or 8 months in a year, if it's business as usual at that time. So then you're at the end of your money at the end of 8 years, and it's not saying, well, wait a minute, who can share the rewards? The reward is that who's going to pay the other 20%? And it seems to me, that's why I was probing the question, is the county the deep pocket that shows up? Is it the hospital the deep pocket? And it seems to me one of the absolute critical questions the CCOs need to ask themselves, and the state needs to ask in evaluating proposals, is who's there to be the payer of last resort when the money runs out? The money doesn't have to run out, but unless you can change the way we do things, certainly in the first year or two, the money is going to run out. And this seems to me, that's going to be the question. I'd be happy to say, you can have all the sharing. You can have all the earnings. I don't want any of it. But you pay the losses, and I don't want any of that either. And that's going to be, I think, the kind of discussion we're going to have. That's the hard one, I think.
And I just want to mention one other thing that really this committee hasn't talked about, and that's women's reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, having worked for the county, so many women use their county health departments to take care of their health. They go in because they want to have their reproductive issues taken care of, and that includes birth control, primarily birth control. They want that. So how are these CCOs going to address women's reproductive health, too? And I would hope...
Well, Madam Chair, isn't that... I mean, the issue is there's also a stream of dollars for that.
Yes, there is.
And I'm assuming that that stream of dollars goes in with all the other streams into this bucket. And then the question is, who provides the services?
That's right. So that's an issue we haven't really talked about, and I would hope that there would be some ideas coming forth on that issue.
Co-Chair Monis Anderson, that's a really good point to bring up, and thank you, Representative Greenlick, about talking about that assumption of that funding stream going in this greater pot, because that really is one of our questions at the local public health level. Reproductive health care has a couple of funding streams, including a Medicaid waiver. Is that part of the CCOs? Is that part of what public health retains and does? As you know, and as I had mentioned, most counties do not provide primary care. We provide clinical services, but they in fact are women's reproductive health care, immunizations, STI exams, those kinds of pieces. And so this is a very big concern. You're right. We are the health care for many of those women and families, but it's not for primary care. So when we talk about the county maybe being a payer of last resort, it's not for primary care for most counties. It's for important care, women's reproductive health care, immunizations, but it is not primary care, even though we are probably the only care many of these people are getting.
I know it is, yes.
I think we've assumed through every one of those Wednesday night meetings that every stream of money that's supporting care for the Medicaid population will go into that bucket. I think if there's any exceptions to that, that's one of the things we need to take into consideration as we draft it.
You know, because if you look at our home visiting services, which are both for maternal child health home visiting and for healthy homes, asthma reduction, county health departments do draw down targeted case management funding. We don't bill Care Oregon or Family Net. We go directly to DMAP, but that is a carve out. And so as you look at these
these dollars and you make those kinds of decisions, please know that those are the funding streams that keep the services in county health departments to both within our clinics and within our home-based services currently is that those Medicaid funding streams.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So not to be argumentative, but so you talk about primary care and you say immunization and reproductive health and the type of work you do with women in their clinics for reproductive health is not primary care. Why do you make that designation?
Co-Chair Mona Sanderson, Representative Kotek, thank you. That's a good question. Because it's just pieces of the care. It is not holistic. It does not involve looking at diabetes screening. It does not look at cholesterol. It doesn't look at, when we go to a doctor for our primary care physician, our healthcare provider really looks at us as an individual and all of the care that we need. When families come to most county health departments, it is because they need immunizations or family planning services. And while those are good, high-quality services, they are limited to those particular pieces of care. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Well, it does, but I think we've arbitrarily made those decisions. I mean,
that's right.
And we have to fix that because when we talk about physical health in the CCO bill, my assumption is physical health does include reproductive health, does include all those things that you're doing. So we just have to get past making a separation there on those topics. We've done that because of how we funded them, who does them. But
that's actually very helpful in terms of looking at that. We would also have the assumption that everyone that is covered within a CCO would get that care within that system and how that would look. I think that's a real benefit because they will then, in fact, get the primary care that we would want everyone to be able to have, but not everyone will be covered by a CCO. So how do we provide services for the people that are not a member of a CCO? What does that look like, and how do we fund that?
But I think that we will continue this conversation later, but I think we have to think outside the box. When I was in my reproductive years, rarely went to a primary physician. Didn't need him. And I think many women are like that. So, well, anyway.
Is that because your doctor never asked you about it?
Because you're more comfortable seeing doctors that deal with it.
Well, I think those are systemic things.
That's right.
Thank you.
We women feel this is important. All right. Thank you very much. I would like, we didn't really invite anyone else. If there's someone really burning out there to make a comment, and I see no one raising their hand.
Yay.
With that, we're adjourned.
Next Wednesday then with the bill?
Yeah, I think we'll